Chapter 7 The Wrong Branches. The challenge for the 21st century is to place human behavior on a more solidly scientific foundation, and to ensure that all children have the maximum opportunity to develop the potentials with which they have been born. Freudian theory would appear to have no role in this endeavor, since it has no scientific base. It will slowly fade from view, therefore, just as the Cheshire Cat once did, except that in this case, the grin will fade first, and the genitals last of all. E. Fuller Torrey, Freudian Fraud. The medical profession embraces the conceit that when errors occur in understanding a disease condition, devotion to the scientific method makes these errors transient and self-correcting. But in the latter half of the 20th century, historians and sociologists of science began calling attention to the idea that errors in science are often caused, and therefore perpetuated, by the beliefs and prejudices of practitioners. Out of the complex interaction between facts and evidence and deeply held beliefs, scientific errors can be pervasive and long-lasting, while the truth remains hidden. And because of the economic incentives of drug manufacturers, practicing physicians, and powerful specialists, the medical industry is especially vulnerable to long-lasting error, as we've seen in the cases of syphilis, hysteria, and acrodynia. So it shouldn't be at all surprising that Leo Kanner's early failure to observe important patterns in his first cluster of cases didn't correct itself very quickly. Quite the contrary, Kanner's error metastasized, and unfortunately, Kanner himself played an active role in that process. Perhaps he was lured by the prospect of the immortality that might accrue to the discoverer of Kanner's syndrome. More likely, he was overwhelmed by the profound influence of the Freudians in America's post-war psychiatry community. Regardless of his motivations, for a man with such independent habits of mind early on, the latter part of Kanner's career was marked by far lesser contributions than the first. Still, among the many errors of the medical industry as the age of autism spread like a cancer, Leo Kanner's contributions were far from the most harmful. Autism's leading Freudian theorist, Bruno Bettelheim, turned an accusatory eye on the mothers of autistic children, arguing that women like Elizabeth Peabody Trevett, Miriam Partridge Speck, and Rachel Carey Muncy were at fault for their children's autism. While conventional wisdom has it that Bettelheim promoted the concept of refrigerator mothers, it was Kanner who first used the term. But Bettelheim's view was far darker than that. Autism science pursued the wrong branches at almost every turn. Bettelheim's views were celebrated, while clear evidence of a role for occupational chemical exposures in families was ignored. And as one parent's personal crusade to debunk Bettelheim succeeded, rising interest in the biology of the autistic syndromes turned the field not to environmental injury, but instead to genetics, launching decades of research from which little has been gained. Fortunately, there were a few bright spots in an otherwise dark period for families affected by autism, Bettelheim's fall from repute foremost among them. Since the clues about the role of environmental factors in autism have been ignored for so long, it is worthwhile to expose the erroneous commitments made by former experts in autism so that we can trace their roots into the present day and correct the record. For as David Wooten observed in the case of penicillin, discovered 2 centuries after the requisite technology for its discovery was in place, the question is not so much what led to the truth in the end. It's what took so long. Autism grows. In 1956, 13 years after Kanner published his original paper on autism, a Navy psychologist in San Diego named Bernard Rimland and his wife Gloria had their first child, a son they named Mark. Mark, showed all the hallmarks of early infantile autism and was soon formally diagnosed. By then, autism, while still rare, was well known in the medical community. Since Kanner's 1943 paper, the syndrome had gained increasing attention for its remarkable combination of features. In 1952, Dutch psychiatrist Arne van Creveldein said that he had started to doubt autism's existence because he hadn't yet seen a case. But when he finally did, the doubts disappeared. Each child was as much like those described by Kanner as one raindrop is like another. And often early cases he saw, interestingly enough, one was the child of a horticulturalist, and another the child of a florist's salesman, both possible signs of fungicide exposure, as we saw in Kanner's original case series. Like Beeman Triplett, Rimland sent Kanner a case file on his son Mark and corresponded with him. He also began a treatment for him, an approach that has since come to be described as biomedical, making use of supplements, dietary changes, and other interventions, rather than prescription drugs to blunt unwanted behaviors. The practice is based in the belief that autism has its roots in a child's metabolic and immune processes, as well as his or her susceptibility to toxins. Rimmer told Kanner he had been trying a product called Diener, a substance some believed could elevate mood, intelligence, and memory. Like Donald Triplett, who unbeknownst to Rimland had improved dramatically after Gold Salts treatment 7 years earlier, his son seemed better. Many people have commented on Mark's improvement, Rimland wrote Kanner. He is using a little speech now, not just fragments in a high piping voice. He is naming pictures in books for the first time, and there is progress in toilet training. Where before, on returning from work, it was common to hear him screaming in part of an hour-long tantrum, I now often find him opening the door for me with a smile. Convinced that he and Gloria had done nothing to make Mark this severely disabled, and encouraged by his medical interventions, Rimland put every waking moment outside his day job into autism research. I have spent many hundreds of hours studying the literature on infantile autism and related subjects. I still have not finished, but I believe I have come close to reading all that has been written on the topic in English. I have been mainly concerned with trying to find biological factors which might eventually help beat the problem. Rimland fell asleep many nights on the floor of his study, but even getting his hands on the material was a challenge. He told Kanner he was waiting for the July issue of the American Journal of Mental Deficiency, but it is 3 weeks overdue at the college library, and I'm tired of stopping there almost daily to see if it would have arrived. It would be another 2 decades before Rimland would help put together the first study to search for the biological factors he suspected, and stumble across systematic evidence of a chemical connection in the parents' backgrounds. And it would be even longer before these insights blossomed into a widespread movement by parents who, frustrated with the medical profession, tried the kinds of approaches that appeared to help Donald Triplett and Mark Rimland. Meanwhile, reports of autism increased. First, a trickle, then a torrent. By the time Autistic Disturbances was published in 1943, 2 more cases of autism had been referred to Kanner. He called the disorder rare enough, yet it is probably more frequent than is indicated by the paucity of observed cases. A comment that may have reflected what he knew, but his readers had no way of telling, that many of those first 11 cases were close at hand, clustered in Maryland, and among families with some sort of medical connection to Hopkins. By 1946, just 3 years later, he already had the occasion to observe 23 children whose extreme withdrawal and disability to form the usual relations to people were noticed from the beginning of life. In this first follow-up, he focused on the language difficulties demonstrated by autistic children. Repeating the tale of Donald T., he added several new accounts. J.S., not quite 4 years old, referred to himself as Blum, whenever his veracity was questioned by his parents. The mystery of this irrelevance was explained when Jay, who could read fluently, once pointed to the advertisement of a furniture firm in the newspapers, which said in large letters, "Blum tells the truth." Since Jay told the truth, he was Blum. Canner took the occasion to defend his cases as a new disorder, showing how each additional child fit with the striking peculiarities observed in the first 11. "I have designated this condition as early infantile autism," he wrote, having settled on the phrase in 1944. Phenomenologically, excessive aloneness and an anxiously excessive desire for the preservation of sameness are the outstanding characteristics. Memory is often astounding. Cognitive endowment, masked frequently by limited responsiveness, is at least average. And he continued to observe what he thought was an important pattern. Most patients stem from psychometrically superior, though literal-minded and obsessive families. By 1949, it seems likely that the shadow of Sigmund Freud was darkening his view. He wrote, "The parents' behavior toward the children must be seen to be fully appreciated. Maternal lack of genuine warmth is often conspicuous in the first visit to the clinic." He described Donald and his mother. Donald sat down next to his mother on the sofa. She kept moving away from him as though she could not bear the physical proximity. When Donald moved along with her, she finally told him coldly to go and sit in a chair. Canner seemed not to consider that the parent-child relationship was mutual, that the failure of the child to respond was difficult for the parents, and that many of the children had physical problems that added to the difficulty. Nevertheless, he had to acknowledge that the parents behaved responsibly. Most of the patients were exposed from the beginning to parental coldness, obsessiveness, and a mechanical type of attention to material needs only. Yet the mothers were anxious to do a good job, and this meant mechanized service of the kind which is rendered by an over-conscientious gasoline station attendant. Pediatricians' instructions were carried out to the letter. In 1952, he wrote about two more cases and began introducing language that would turn the parents into an unfeeling appliance. He claimed that the children's therapy has been sabotaged by emotionally refrigerated parents incapable of defrosting. The vast majority of parents, though competent in their chosen profession, are cold, detached, humorless perfectionists, more at home in the realm of abstractions than in the world of people. In Canner's early writings, then, we can find the roots of the concept of the refrigerator mother. In the journal article, Early Infantile Autism, 1943-1955, he and Hopkins' colleague, Leon Eisenberg, crossed explicitly into a causation. "The emotional frigidity in the typical autistic family suggests a dynamic experiential factor in the genesis of the disorder in the child." Emotional frigidity in the genesis of the disorder. Here, Canner first places autism squarely on the parents. A lack of affective contact toward their children led to a lack of affective contact from their children. To convey just how coldly these parents treated their offspring, Canner cited the case of Brian, who was one of twins born despite contraceptive efforts, much to the distress of his parents. Their plans centered about graduate study and had no room for children. The mother, a psychology student, decided to raise the twins scientifically, that is, not to be picked up if crying except on schedule. At 5 months, the other twin died. This, Canner said, resulted from their rigid approach that led them to ignore the child's health crisis, and the mother withdrew from the remaining child even more completely and spent her days locked in the study, reading. This case, an extreme instance chosen for emphasis, can serve as a paradigm of the emotional refrigeration that has been the common lot of autistic children. This extraordinary turn against the parents, less than a decade after Kanner's first description of the disorder, may have effectively blinded him. Perhaps if he had looked away from the parents' behavior, Kanner might have seen clues to environmental harm of a different kind. But as Kanner bored deeper into the parents' psyche, he grappled with the inconsistencies of his theory. Why didn't all of their children have autism, and why did many parents simply not fit the pattern of emotional refrigeration? It is difficult to escape the conclusion that this emotional configuration in the home plays a dynamic role in the genesis of autism, he wrote. But he also began devising an escape plan, conceding that it seems to us equally clear that this factor, while important in the development of the syndrome, is not sufficient in itself to result in its appearance. With every new case, Kanner saw parents' backgrounds as signs of toxic parenting, not toxic exposures. When he reached 100 cases, Kanner reported that the children almost invariably came from intelligent and sophisticated stock. 74 of the fathers were college graduates, almost twice today's percentage, and he meticulously compiled their professions. 31 businessmen, 12 engineers, 11 physicians, 10 lawyers, 8 tradesmen, 5 chemists, 5 military officers, 3 with a Ph.D. in science, 2 with a Ph.D. in the humanities. The clear subsets of chemical connection within this group, chemists, engineers, tradesmen, doctors, scientists, are flagrantly obvious. And this is without even considering the mother's backgrounds, some of which pointed just as strongly to toxic exposures that could even more directly harm the fetus and infant. The cases kept coming. There were 120 by 1957, 150 by 1958. The syndrome was static, the children identical as raindrops, to use Van Creveland's phrase. But something new began to emerge. Kanner noted in 1955, the case material has expanded to include a number of children who reportedly developed normally through the first 18 to 20 months of life, only to undergo at this point a severe withdrawal of affect, manifested by the loss of language function, failure to progress socially, and the gradual giving up in normal activities. These latter cases have invariably been severe and unresponsive. When seen, they could not be differentiated from the children with the more classical account of detachment apparently present in the neonatal period. But even these cases are much earlier in onset and phenomenologically distinct from cases of childhood schizophrenia. Regressive cases were starting to appear, yet Kanner took pains to group these cases who regressed during infancy together with those in whom autism seemed inborn, separating them from children who exhibited some form of later-onset regression, that is, during the childhood period after 3 years of age. And while the timing of autism's onset began to vary in these reports from what he gave in his original paper, Kanner remarked in 1958 that autism continued to be both rare and remarkable. The fact that an average of not more than 8 patients per year over a span of 20 years could be diagnosed with reasonable assurance as autistic in a center serving as a sort of diagnostic clearinghouse speaks for the infrequency of the disease, especially if one considers that they recruit themselves from all over the North American continent. But if autism was rare, exactly how rare was it? What was the prevalence rate? Not just in the United States, but in other countries that were starting to take note of this striking syndrome. The first surveys. The earliest studies of autism rates are interesting, not only for what they found, but for where they were done. The locations of these early surveys align remarkably with the places we have already visited on our journey through the history of mercury poisoning and pollution. Victor Lotter's 1966 survey in Middlesex County, England, was the first of its kind. the oldest survey ever published of autism prevalence rates in a defined population. His prevalence estimate of 4.1 per 10,000, 1 in 2,400, set the standard for the generally accepted disease frequency of autism, repeated for decades to follow. For many current parents whose children were born in the 1990s, Lauter's rate of 4 to 5 per 10,000 was still the rate of autism quoted when they wanted to know how unlucky they really were. The first attempt to scientifically establish the autism rate in the United States was in Wisconsin in 1970. Darold Treffert found a very low rate of classic infantile autism in 0.7 per 10,000 children born in the 1950s and 1960s. Using a broader definition that included onset later in childhood, he reported an overall rate of 3.1 per 10,000. Treffert was assigned to the children's unit of one of Wisconsin's mental health institutes, among the few such specialized child psychiatric units in the country. Out of 800 patients at the institute, 30 were children under the age of 18, and most of these were autistic. Soon it was decided to separate them out. Treffert was well aware that the idea of refrigerator mothers was then in vogue, and that Kanner's studies had shown a high level of education in the parents of autistic children. But he took issue with Kanner's interpretation. The mothers of the autistic children on our unit looked to me like any other mothers, he told us. They were caring, concerned, involved, and not aloof. Certainly not refrigerator, and adding guilt to an already heavy burden seemed so cruel. And I thought also that Kanner's observations regarding educational level, which fed into the refrigerator stereotype somewhat, was probably a reflection of the nature of his referral practice at Johns Hopkins. Treffert concluded that the study of a statewide sample might help refute the refrigerator parent theory. He was confident that his role in the children's clinic put him in touch with the full population of autistic children in Wisconsin at the time. Although autism was not a recognized diagnosis in DSM until 1980, Treffert knew children with autism were likely to have a diagnosis of childhood schizophrenia, and he collected records for all such children throughout the state. Given Frederick Wellman's roots in the plant pathology scientific community that was centered around the University of Wisconsin, Treffert's pioneering effort there doesn't surprise us. Still, the low rate of autism, just 1 in 10,000, excluding later-onset cases, provides validation for Kanner's belief that autism remained rare. Studies began cropping up in other countries around the same time. Japan, where we already observed a tragic history of environmental mercury contamination, had the most. Sweden, where alkyl mercury poisoning triggered the first so-called silent spring, was second. Of 24 studies published by 1991, 9 were in Japan, 4 in Sweden, 4 in the United States, and 3 in the British Isles, including the first study to be published. This distribution raises a question. Does the creation of a diagnostic category stimulate a demand for corresponding surveys, or would a greater number of epidemiological surveys reflect those places where autism was first emerging? Despite its discovery in the United States, surveys conducted have reported lower rates than in Japan and Scandinavia. But one American study conducted in 1975 provides perhaps the best marker against which to judge the trends that have since unfolded. E. Fuller Torrey and colleagues used data from the National Collaborative Perinatal Project to conduct a study. Instead of looking for cases in a set population at one point in time, this prospective study followed a population of newborn babies and observed their development. Torrey's study was specifically designed to investigate bleeding during pregnancy as a risk factor for autism and childhood psychosis. To do so, it examined the computerized records of 30,000 children a huge sample, born between 1959 and 1965 at 14 university-affiliated medical centers. All the children received several neurological, psychological, speech, and hearing exams by age 8. From this group, 14 were selected as conforming to the syndrome of infantile autism, Torrey reported. That translated to a rate of 4.7 autistic children per 10,000. The researchers wrote that although they make no claim to having identified every autistic child among the 30,000 children, the rate of 4.7 per 10,000 was almost identical to that reported by Lotter's Middlesex County study in England, leading us to believe that most such children were included. The researchers also reviewed the examination reports of additional children who, although not having the classical syndrome of infantile autism, were apparently psychotic. 6 such children were found, all labeled by at least one observer as severely disturbed, psychotic-like, autistic, or childhood schizophrenic. Adding in those children gave a combined rate of 6.7 per 10,000 children. The power of this study, besides its large size, came from the fact that it was prospective and followed a large population closely to observe a whole range of developmental outcomes. These autism rates, of course, are far below later prevalent studies. A comprehensive 2004 review put autism at around 30 or 40 per 10,000 for full syndrome, or Kanner autism, and about 67 per 10,000 for the broader diagnostic category that includes Asperger's and pervasive developmental disorder, at least 10 times higher than Torrey's prospective analysis. The most recent estimate puts rates even higher than this. When early researchers went looking for autism in the Third World, they found even lower rates. More than 30 years ago, Victor Lotter took a tour of Africa looking for autism cases. He didn't attempt a full prevalence study. Instead, he simply went to visit collections of mentally handicapped children in institutions in hopes that he would be able to find evidence of autism in these high concentrations of mentally impaired children. He visited 9 cities in 6 African countries: Ghana, Nigeria, Kenya, Zimbabwe, Zambia, and South Africa, in search of as many cases of autism as he could find. Although not a full-scale population survey, Lotter personally screened more than 1,300 mentally handicapped children during a 2-year period. So what Lotter found in Africa surprised him, namely, that the number of autistic children found was much smaller than expected. Within a population already diagnosed with a mental handicap, one would expect to find a higher rate of autism, since the population had been screened to exclude any typical children. Only 9 of the 1,312 mentally handicapped children he saw in 9 cities were autistic, a rate of 1 in 145, less than the autism rate today in the entire U.S. childhood population. He had expected to see more than 1 in 20 in such a high concentration of mentally disabled children. Around that time, clinicians in Nigeria and later in Kenya confirmed that autism indeed was present among African children, but found it rare enough that it was worthwhile for them to give detailed profiles of just 4 and 3 cases, respectively. Unfailingly, when autism was found by early researchers in Africa, it occurred in elite families. Lotter reported that there was amongst all the children originally selected as possible cases an excess of the elite. This excess was even greater amongst the autistic children than amongst non-autistic children. Lotter defined as elite any child who had been born abroad, Britain, Europe, or North America, or had lived for any period abroad, or whose parent or parents had lived for any period abroad, or whose father had a non-manual job. Lotter's finding was supported by other researchers as well. All four cases in the Nigerian report came from elite families, as did the three Kenyan children, the parents of whom included a medical doctor, an engineer, and the chairman of a parastatal organization. This interpretation of autism suited some academic observers who were eager to blame, if not simply the parents, then society and social class for autism. Infantile autism, wrote Victor Sanua, in a 1984 paper that reviewed the evidence of autism in Africa, appears to be an illness of Western civilization and appears in countries of high technology where the nuclear family dominates. The idea that the risk of Western civilization might be real, but boiled down to something different, concrete and quite specific, seems never to have occurred to Dr. Sanua. And in this, we hear the echo of Emil Kraepelin and Leo Kanner in their search for general paralysis of the insane in indigenous cultures. The mutant spawn of Sigmund Freud. As we've seen, for a time, Kanner hesitantly supported a Freudian-influenced view of autism, even though he reported its presence from the beginning of life. Pure Freudians like J. Louise Despert had no such hesitation. But the clear leader of the pack was Bruno Bettelheim. He commented in 1981, "All my life, I have been working with children whose lives were destroyed because their mothers hated them." Bettelheim was perhaps the most malignant force ever unleashed on families coping with autism. Bruno Bettelheim was born in Vienna in 1903, 3 years after Freud's pivotal analysis of 18-year-old Dora Bauer. Like Dora's father, Bettelheim's had syphilis, and while we think Dora was affected by the mercury treatment Freud almost certainly prescribed her father, Bruno Bettelheim's circumstances do appear to reflect psychological dysfunction. Gloom hung over the household, a biographer writes. Decades later, Bruno would tell his own children that, as a young boy, he did not know what caused the oppressive climate in his home, but a fear that he may have created it caused him great anxiety about his own sexuality. As a teenager, Bettelheim read Freud, initially to impress a girl whose interest in both Freud and Bettelheim quickly waned. But Bettelheim remained captivated by the sage of Vienna. He hovered around the outer edges of the intellectual milieu, taking art and aesthetics at the University of Vienna. But he also had family obligations. His father owned a company, and so, aware of his father's precarious health, Bettelheim also studied business and bookkeeping. That ended in 1938 when the Anschluss handed Austria to its native son, Adolf Hitler, now the Reichsführer of Germany. Soon thereafter, Bettelheim ended up in Dachau and then Buchenwald. Released before they became extermination camps, he made his way to the United States, settled in Chicago, where he established contacts with the University of Chicago and remade himself as a student of Freud. In 1943, the same year, coincidentally, that Leo Kanner published Autistic Disturbances, he recounted his concentration camp experiences in a journal article, Individual and Mass Behavior in Extreme Situations. Its early glimpse into the depravity of the camps, along with a detached and objective tone, made his name in the United States, where he became an overnight sensation. Hired by the University of Chicago, he began to treat disturbed children and developed a theory of autism that compared the experience of an autistic child with that of a concentration camp inmate, emotional withdrawal in fear of their lives. In his book, The Empty Fortress, 1967, he wrote of a type of prisoner called Muslims. Interestingly, he had not mentioned them in his original 1943 paper on concentration camp life, who broke down after being terrorized by the guards. Thus, what was startling about the experience in the camps was that Though the overpowering conditions were the same for many prisoners, not all succumbed. Only those showed schizophrenic-like reactions, who felt they were not only helpless to deal with the new situation, but that this was their inescapable fate. These deteriorated to near autistic behavior when the feeling of doom penetrated so deep that it brought the added conviction of imminent death. Such men were called Muslims in the camps, and other prisoners avoided them as if in fear of contagion. It is not an overstatement to call Bettelheim a fraud. He falsely claimed degrees in philosophy, psychology, and the history of art. Far worse, given what was to come, he maintained that he was an experienced professor, had taught courses in normal and abnormal psychology, and belonged in Vienna to an association of professional psychologists and educators which studied the developmental problems of children and adolescents. But given the gripping backstory of his time in a concentration camp and his personal charisma, not to mention the fact that the Nazis had destroyed most of the documentation necessary to check such claims, Bettelheim gained a wide and admiring audience. His home base was the Orthogenic School at the University of Chicago, which became the home for several dozen children at any one time undergoing his intensive but supposedly benevolent treatment. In fact, multiple witnesses came forward after his death to say he held the parents at bay, browbeat the staff, and physically beat the children. He turned these children's stories into literary sensations, such as Joey the Mechanical Boy in 1959 in Scientific American. It was a portrait of a schizophrenic child and a masterpiece of Freudian mumbo-jumbo. Placing the blame exclusively on the mothers, Bettelheim elaborated an extravagant theory that could even explain what to Kanner appeared an inborn disturbance. The conditions of life that made Joey decide to be a mechanical contrivance instead of a person began before he was born. At birth, his mother thought of him as a thing rather than a person. But even before that, he made little impression. "I never knew I was pregnant," she said, meaning that consciously the pregnancy did not alter her life. His birth, too, did not make any difference. Of course, to Bettelheim, all this had roots in the parents' own deep-seated problems. It was all about the parents, whom Bettelheim proceeded to treat. Psychotherapy helped the mother to realize how much she initially felt trapped in her marriage, how for years she had only thought she loved her husband, poor misguided woman, while all her deeper feelings had lain dormant. The father needed much less therapy. Of course he did. He was not the one whose pathology was so severe it made Joey autistic. Bettelheim has been derided as inventing the term refrigerator mothers. As we've seen, Kanner's use of refrigerators actually predated Bettelheim. But Bettelheim's critique went far deeper. They were homicidal mothers, and the infants knew this. They sensed their mother's murderous intent and withdrew from the world. This sounds so implausibly extreme that it is worth letting Bettelheim spell it out himself. Despite the incredible variety of symptoms among the several hundred schizophrenic children we have worked with over the years, they all shared one thing in common: an unremitting fear for their lives. The more autistic the schizophrenic child, the more debilitating his symptoms, the greater is his mortal anxiety. Autistic children, in particular, not only fear constantly for their lives, they seem convinced death is imminent, that possibly it can be postponed just for moments through their not taking cognizance of life. I believe the initial cause of withdrawal is rather the child's correct interpretation, emphasis added, of the negative emotions with which the most significant figures in his environment approach him. This, in turn, evokes rage in the child till he begins, as even mature persons do, to interpret the world in the image of his anger. All of us do that occasionally, and all children do it more than occasionally. The tragedy of children fated to become autistic is that such a view of the world happens to be correct for their world. In this way, Leo Kanner fixated on the aloof parenting of autistic children, and Bruno Bettelheim focused on the mother's actively homicidal impulses, never noticed chemical exposure in the background of families with autistic children. But others did. Chemical exposures. In the spring of 1974, Bernard Rimland's group, the National Society for Autistic Children, held its annual conference, meeting that year in Washington, D.C. Since a number of autistic children would be gathered in one place, Rimland decided it might be an opportunity to research the biological basis of autism, and he reached out to the Children's Brain Research Clinic, which agreed to conduct a detailed study. The lead researcher was Dr. Mary Coleman of Georgetown University. A total of 78 autistic children participated, and the local chapter also provided the necessary controls, unaffected children, matched by age and sex. For the first time, Coleman and Rimland began to explore the question of subgroups and biological causation. They hypothesized there were three clusters of autistic children. One was made up of cases that seemed to run in families. Another was a group that had gastrointestinal issues and sensitivity to wheat. They called this group celiac autism. The third group showed signs of a metabolic disturbance, in particular the purine pathway, which produces molecules like adenosine and uric acid, seemed abnormal. Each of these three clusters reflected themes: genetic susceptibility, gastrointestinal difficulties, and disturbances of a particular biological pathway that have endured to some degree. In terms of causation, some interesting additional data emerged from the detailed questionnaire. There were two areas of marked difference between the parents of the autistic children and parents of controls. One of these areas was exposure to chemicals. In 20 families of autistic patients, an unusual amount of exposure to chemicals had occurred during the preconception period. In 4 of these families, both mother and father had been exposed to chemicals, mostly with the parents working as chemists. Of the control parents, there was only one family. Again, both the father and the mother, who were working as chemists in a laboratory. Was this an alarm bell, 30 years after Kanner's original signals were missed, to home in on toxins in the etiology of autism? Coleman said it should be, since the incidence of individuals exposed to chemicals in all related occupations in the United States is 1.1% of the population. To find that 25% of any sample has had chemical exposure is quite startling. The other difference Coleman found in parents of autistic children was the increased rate in the mother's preconception histories of hypothyroidism, an autoimmune disorder. These results were indeed quite startling, but they also reflected a self-selected sample of parents coming to Washington for a meeting of a national autism group. Coleman reasoned that perhaps only children whose families reflected a chemically induced illness would participate in this kind of study, thereby skewing the results. So the question remained, would a chemical connection hold up if the possibility of selection bias were eliminated? One of Coleman's graduate students, Thomas Felicetti, put the theory to an additional test. The experimental design compared the occupations of 20 parents of autistic children, 20 parents of mentally retarded children, and 20 parents of normal children, who were friends and neighbors of those attending the Avalon School in Massachusetts, where he taught at the time. The results confirmed Coleman and Rimland's original finding. 8 of the 37 known parents of the autistic children had sustained occupational exposure to chemicals prior to conception. 5 were chemists, and 3 worked in related fields. The exposed parents represent 21% of the autistic group. This compared to 2.7% of the retardation controls and 10% of the normal controls. Felicetti concluded, "The results of this study point in the direction of chemical exposure as an etiological factor in the birth of autistic children." Felicetti, now executive director of Beechwood Rehabilitation Services in Langhorne, Pennsylvania, is quick to acknowledge that such a small study was not definitive. This particular study was occupations, and it was all different occupations, he told us. But again, that's as far as I went with it. It was a pretty good study, but suggestive, because we couldn't find any particular chemical, and because we only looked at occupations. Felicetti acknowledged that careers like plant pathologist and forestry professor, cases 2 and 3 in Kanner's original paper, met the criteria for a chemical connection. The study also went against the class observations of so many other reports. It did try to have the control groups of equal occupation and social class, Felicetti said. Contrary to all the speculation that brain power and education correlate with autistic offspring, job status seemed to have nothing to do with it. Nor was that the last sign of a chemical connection. Another research effort looked again at the same prospective study of children in which Torrey and colleagues found a 4.7 per rate of autism. It, too, found a higher incidence of occupations involving exposure to chemicals among the small set of parents of children with autism. Despite the power of these findings, at least to generate hypotheses about toxic exposures in the etiology of autism, they failed to produce further studies. The call from Coleman, a widely respected and thoroughly mainstream scientist, for more research, was ignored. One of Felicetti's observations in the 1981 article is haunting. It is especially ironic that many of the parents of the autistic youngsters in our study could not specify the nature of the chemical agents. One can only speculate that they had blind faith in the safety precautions of the plants and in the reassurances of their employers. In a similar spirit, we do not argue that ethyl mercury exposure would have been identifiable in every one of these cases, only that the original 11 Kanner cases showed a link to newly commercialized ethyl mercury compounds. Moreover, the subsequent studies that found convincing evidence of chemical exposures by then could have included a wider array of toxins, both from industrial and household chemicals, and from more widely administered and more frequent vaccinations. It is important to note that the field of toxicology research has identified multiple instances in which different chemicals converge on identical pathways. We'll return to the implications of these findings for analyzing the association between chemical exposure and autism, or any other disease, later. Meanwhile, as autism reached epidemic proportions, the chemical connection signal would become harder to detect because it was more universally shared. Eventually, this first suggestion of chemical involvement faded away entirely and was overwhelmed by other biological concepts, including the familiar territory of germ theory and, ultimately, genetics. Indeed, one germ in particular caught the attention of scientists around this time. This was fueled in part by an epidemic that swept the world in the 1960s and seemed to trigger, at least in a few places, an unusually high rate of autism. The brief age of rubella-related autism. Scientists are uncertain about the origins of the rubella virus. We do know that it has been around for a long time and is in large measure harmless, lasting a few days with a course so innocuous that no one ever really commented on it. Rubella was only identified as a distinct disease by German physicians in the 1700s, hence one of its names, German measles, to differentiate it from regular measles and chicken pox. But if a young woman who has not gotten rubella in childhood becomes infected during pregnancy the risk can be quite serious for the developing embryo. The disease known as congenital rubella syndrome, CRS, can cause deafness and muteness. We have witnessed conditions like these for eons, and it's likely that a significant number of them were triggered by rubella in the mother. Congenital rubella can also be life-threatening, with a high rate of spontaneous abortion, infant mortality, and infant heart defects. For a long time, this severe manifestation of the disease went unnoticed, in part because rubella was similar to measles, rubeola, and other diseases that come with rashes, like chickenpox, or even syphilis. As Australian physician Charles Swan remarked, in view of the universal occurrence of German measles, it seems curious that, if congenital defects frequently followed a maternal attack during pregnancy, the connection between the two conditions was not discovered earlier. But frequently, the mothers didn't realize or remember they had been infected, given the generally mild course of the disease. More to the point, the problem with identifying the effect on pregnant women and their fetuses was latency, the gap between the infection in the mother and the symptoms in the child. We now know the earlier infection during pregnancy, the more severe the damage to the fetus. At the same time, that puts a longer distance between the timing of the exposure and the recognition of the damage. For all these reasons, it's easy to understand how congenital rubella syndrome was not recognized until relatively recently. In 1940, a particularly severe outbreak of German measles hit army training camps in Australia, and a large number of troops brought it home and infected their wives. The next year, Dr. Norman McAllister Gregg of Sydney, an ophthalmologist, noticed he was being referred an unusual number of infants with congenital cataracts. Some also had serious heart problems. Gregg checked with colleagues in New South Wales and Victoria, and soon had compiled 78 such cases. In 68 of them, he realized, the mothers reported having German measles either right before or very early in pregnancy. Other such cases showed a high rate of deafness. The Medical Journal of Australia broadcast the news in its bulletin for December 6, 1941, while Gregg's paper was awaiting publication in an ophthalmologic journal. Meanwhile, Gregg had little doubt the finding would be confirmed, and it was. First, in Australia, a series of retrospective studies went back and looked at deaf mutism in earlier known rubella epidemics, and found that when a rubella epidemic hit Australia, the birth cohorts that followed shortly thereafter had an unusually high level of deaf-mute cases. An island continent like Australia, where rubella epidemics came in identifiable bursts, made a particularly good laboratory for observing the impact of the rubella virus. But the finding was confirmed in the United States and Europe as well. From the beginning, there were questions about the degree of brain damage that went along with the defects in vision, hearing, and heart function in these cases. Australian clinicians observed that the children had difficulties in intellectual development and learning capacity. Early on, this was a subject of controversy and research, as a debate grew over whether the rubella virus was a primary cause of mental retardation and whether cognitive issues were secondary to the deaf-mute condition. Shortly after Gregg's discovery in 1941, a number of studies around the world took up the question of the mental capacity of congenital rubella victims. By and large, these studies found evidence for some levels of mental retardation, but these rates were generally low, and most of the authors found that the deaf-mute condition explained most of the developmental difficulties. These early studies assigned a rate of mental retardation in congenital rubella anywhere from 2 to 20%. As physicians identified groups of congenital rubella victims, many of them in childhood, several groups were followed over the course of their lifetimes to access the long-term course of the disease. For example, Dr. Gregg's collection of 78 children was followed for 60 years with reports in 1967, 1992, and 2002. These long-term studies showed that CRS took a serious toll, including heart problems, endocrine abnormalities, deafness, and vision loss. Similar long-term studies were conducted in London and New Zealand. By the mid-1950s, it seemed clear what CRS involved, a seriously disabling condition of vision and hearing that included serious health complications, particularly heart disease. Beyond that, there were scattered cases of mental retardation and even a rare case of schizophrenia. But for many CRS victims, the long-term outlook was surprisingly good. As for the effects on the brain, it wasn't clear these were higher than in the general population, and they were difficult to separate from the learning disabilities that went along with deafness and cataracts. Soon after Greg made his discovery, scientists began to look for a rubella treatment, borrowing from the earlier diphtheria treatments that used antitoxins. To obtain rubella antitoxins, an infected person or animal was found, and the blood extracted and processed to concentrate the antibodies that had developed to the disease. Those were then injected in a person who had become infected or exposed to the virus. Early on, there were two varieties of what was called gamma globulin. The first was made from generalized sets of antibodies pooled from large collections of human blood. The second was more targeted, taking blood from a convalescent group that had recently been infected with rubella and presumably had more active and specific antibodies. For most, rubella infection was not a dangerous event, but there was an obvious question about how to prevent or moderate the infection in pregnant women during a rubella outbreak. A number of experiments, some in pregnant women, some in school children, set out to identify a method in the mid-1940s. The goal was to see whether, in the midst of an epidemic, gamma globulin could prevent an infection. Though relatively small and hard to control, the studies generally reported some benefit from treatment. In some cases, the reported benefits were dramatic, in others, more equivocal. But the medical profession was persuaded enough that a 1959 study reporting a limited benefit commented, "Gamma globulin is commonly used to prevent rubella in pregnant women exposed to the disease." By the early 1960s, pooled gamma globulin products, much of them under the name poliomyelitis immune globulin, were produced on a large scale and considered effective. The preservative of choice was thimerosal, ethyl mercury. So just as diphtheria toxoid and later the DPT vaccine had been first introduced to large populations, the commercial immune globulin preparations for rubella treatment were first launched into large populations of pregnant women. Then, in 1962, scientists isolated the rubella virus, which allowed work on the vaccine to begin. But before long, there was a more urgent need to swing into action. With a worldwide rubella epidemic at the start of 1964, a whole new picture began to emerge. Instead of the infection that caused deaf-mute syndrome and occasional cases of mental retardation, the disease as it swept across the United States seemed to have become far more dangerous, with dramatic rates of infant mortality and mental defect. Studies in Baltimore, Houston, and New York showed a far higher incidence of mental retardation and a general picture of devastation in the affected infants that exceeded anything previously reported. A study at Johns Hopkins noted the discrepancy and said that reports from past epidemics would suggest at most a small increase in severe intellectual defects in children suffering from congenital rubella. By contrast, the experience of several groups following patients affected by the 1964 epidemic in the United States suggests that the frequency of severe mental defect is quite high. The Johns Hopkins survey of Baltimore victims of CRS showed at least 29% were severely mentally retarded, and roughly half were severely subnormal. If the Hopkins data were concerning, the implications of a study by Baylor University scientists were even more vivid and disturbing. The Houston group followed 100 patients from birth through the first 18 months of life. In their 1967 report titled Congenital Rubella Encephalitis, they painted a picture of devastation unlike anything seen before. Out of the 100 cases, 20 died in infancy. Of the remainder, 64 were followed. 30 of those had severe neuromotor impairment at 18 months. Only 20 of the original 100 seemed unimpaired. Many of the infants had seizures, and there were frequent reports of abnormal postures and movements, spastic rotations of the legs and feet, dramatic arching of the back, and retracting of the head. For the first time in any CRS study, the Houston group also reported signs of autism. This mention of autism caught the attention of a third research collective in New York City, the Rubella Birth Defect Evaluation Project, in the Department of Pediatrics at New York University. In the Baylor series, of the 64 children surviving at 18 months, the New York group observed, 8 appeared autistic, isolated, and out of communication with the environment. 2 actively rejected by screaming, crying, back arching, any attempt at communication or contact. This NYU group pursued the most organized and careful plan of diagnosis and follow-up, one that continued for several decades thereafter. They recruited a group of CRS cases, carefully characterized them, and stayed in touch for many years. In their first report, they investigated 271 cases of CRS and found a high rate of psychomotor retardation. 65 of the 271 were severe or moderately severe, and 44 additional cases were affected, a rate of 40% of the group. The researchers decided to look more intensively at the rate of autism in the New York CRS cases and found a rate of 7.4%. 18 out of 243 children evaluated were diagnosed with autistic spectrum disorder. They wrote that this revealed a much higher prevalence of behavioral disorders than one would normally expect. This was particularly striking in regard to autism. They went on to describe the rates found by Victor Lotter in England, 4.1 per 10,000, and Darold Treffert in Wisconsin, 0.7 per 10,000, and remarked, "In striking contrast, the prevalence rate in our rubella children would correspond to 412 per 10,000 for the core syndrome of autism, and 329 for the partial syndrome, yielding a combined figure of 741 per 10,000. This was no casual estimate. The authors took pains to emphasize the validity of their assessments. We recognize that the diagnosis of autism requires rigorous justification. The condition is often loosely defined and overdiagnosed. They described their diagnostic criteria in detail. Over the next several years, they followed up on their sample. In a 1978 follow-up, 2 of the original 18 children had improved, and 3 new cases had emerged. So what happened to these children? What caused the dramatic shift in the neurological outcomes of this pre-existing disease? Was the strain of rubella that hit the United States in the 1960s more neurovirulent? That's certainly a possibility, although few observers seem to have made that argument, intimating that their observations were simply more accurate than those of their predecessors. One possible explanation for this outbreak of severe outcomes is changes in the virus itself. But, as we have argued for the effects of mercury, treatment on individuals infected with syphilis, it is also important to consider the possibility that there are unexpected complications of the treatment when it is combined with the underlying pathology of the disease itself. As with the rise of a more toxic presentation of neurosyphilis 300 years after syphilis came to Europe, we're left to consider a treatment effect as a possible factor. As we've seen, the standard of care for women exposed to rubella during pregnancy changed dramatically by the early 1960s, just before the first observations of autism in CRS children, the sharp spike in mental retardation, and the generally worsened outcome. Did gamma globulin treatment and thimerosal that was used to preserve the commercial preparations have something to do with these surprising outcomes? Only one study sheds any light, and that is the New York City groups. Cooper and Krugman, in their discussion of the NYU group, note, "The use of gamma globulin for the prevention of rubella has been a controversial topic for many years." They go on to say, "During the course of the present study, we have identified 31 infants with proved congenital rubella associated with one or more defects in spite of attempted prophylaxis with gamma globulin following exposure." Soon thereafter, in 1969, the rubella vaccine was introduced based on the identification of the virus itself 7 years earlier. The vaccine proved to be a more effective weapon against congenital rubella than thimerosal containing gamma globulin, a treatment strategy Cooper and Krugman called unpredictable and unreliable. The successful subsequent introduction of the rubella vaccine counts among the most successful vaccine programs ever instituted, as congenital rubella has disappeared from the United States, although it persists around the world. Looking back, the verdict on gamma globulin treatment becomes substantially more negative, and it seems likely, as in the case of syphilis, that using no treatment would have been better than injecting pregnant women with a mercury-containing product. In fact, the combination of the treatment and the rubella exposure seemed to be the most dangerous outcome of all. A 1961 study in North Carolina, admittedly a small sample, showed a rate of 16% abnormal outcomes in congenital rubella exposure alone. 6% of these were mentally retarded. Gamma globulin treatment by itself also showed a high rate of abnormal outcomes, with no rubella exposure. 6% of these pregnancies had an abnormal outcome. But the highest rate of abnormal outcomes came in children exposed to both gamma globulin and rubella. Out of 8 children exposed to both gamma globulin and rubella, 2 were abnormal and 1 was mentally retarded. Was autism, as an outcome of congenital rubella, another example of a disease of the remedy? It certainly appears possible that infection of the rubella virus combined with an ineffective and toxic treatment could have contributed to the number of cases of autism observed in the United States in the mid-1960s. As gamma globulin therapies fell out of favor in the 1970s, the connection between autism and congenital rubella has faded, both from memory and the current clinical case record. Yet, although congenital rubella syndrome has disappeared from most developed countries because of the herd immunity gained from widespread use of the rubella vaccine, it persists in many less developed parts of the world. Surprisingly, in more recent reports from developing countries, the familiar profile of deaf-mute syndrome, cataracts, and heart disease is reported, but with a far more benign neurological picture than the horrific one that emerged in the Houston area after 1965. In the meantime, the World Health Organization estimates 100,000 new cases of CRS still occur every year and cites the numerous birth defects that go along with these cases, including deafness, blindness, heart disease, and mental retardation. But it does not mention autism. In one example, a 2005 study in Oman of 43 children found eye, ear, and heart problems, as well as neurological manifestations, including microcephaly, cerebral palsy, and seizure disorder, but no autism. In a second report following a large outbreak in Brazil, investigators identified several dozen cases of CRS and similar outcomes, but no autism. Congenital rubella has long been a puzzle. Joseph Warkany, the doctor who first identified acrodynia, commented on difficulties of connecting maternal rubella infections and subsequent deaf-mute syndrome in their children, offering an apologia for pediatricians who for many years missed the correlation between the maternal disease and the anomalies in the offspring. In that light, it would not be surprising if the disease of a short-lived remedy would also go unnoticed. Burney's first revolution. The same year the rubella epidemic hit the United States, 1964, Bernard Rimland drew together his long search for a theory of autism into a book. Infantile Autism, The Syndrome, and Its Implications for a Neural Theory of Behavior. Although its full impact would take years to unfold, it powerfully countered the idea that parental behavior had anything to do with autism. Rimland's voluminous reading had continued since his first communication with Leo Kanner in 1959 about his son, Mark. As a Navy psychologist, Rimland was occasionally sent to other cities that had medical school libraries. San Diego did not. Between sessions and at the end of each day's work, Rimland would race to the nearest university library, according to one account. In New Orleans, for example, he skipped the French Quarter and headed off to Tulane, where he talked a guard at the library into letting him into the locked building after hours. He also persuaded friends fluent in other languages to translate medical journal articles. All this played out against the background of Mark's severe autism. Mark's screaming and headbanging were extreme, even by autistic standards. When he got to be about a year old, Rimland's wife, Gloria, said he only cried 12 hours by the clock in a 24-hour period, and we thought we were really living. That was so wonderful. Only 12 hours. Rimland's book never mentions Mark or a personal connection, instead unraveling the case against parents of autistic children in a methodical fashion. Rimland did believe that such parents were unusually intelligent and accomplished, but he didn't think that meant they had personality traits that made their children autistic. He summarizes the arguments for psychogenesis, the idea that the child's emotional environment, that is, parental coldness, triggers autism, and exposed them one by one. Against this list, Rimland lines up 9 reasons to support the case for biological causation. These include the fact that not all parents of autistic children fit the cold and detached profile, that pathogenic parents have normal children, that the siblings of autistic children are generally typical, but that when one identical twin has autism, the other one almost always does too, that autism is usually present from the moment of birth, and that autism is often seen with manifestations of other organic brain damage, suggesting a biological trigger in at least some cases. Finally, he notes an absence of gradations and blends among children with autism. The disorder was always well defined and severe. It fell within narrow parameters. If autism were a reaction to environmental factors, we would expect it to exhibit not only the diversity of manifestations from case to case as a consequence of situational differences, Rimland writes, referring here to family dynamics with his use of the term environmental factors. But in addition, the usual gradations in intensity depending on the adverseness of the environment. While there is variation in severity and in prognosis, the degree of variation does not account for the large void between autism and normal behavior. There have been few serious attempts to deny the existence of this void. Rimland appealed to the heart, as well as the head, arguing from a moral basis. Whatever may be the merit in being patient with psychogenesis as a hypothesis, there is much less in being patient with it as an assumed force in fact. The all-too-common practice of blatantly assuming that psychogenic etiology can exist or does exist in any individual case or in any given class of disorders is not only unwarranted, but actively pernicious. In 1964, at a time when fissures were starting to appear in the Freudian foundations of psychiatry, these were winning arguments, buttressed by the fact that Leo Kanner himself wrote Rimland's introduction. From that point on, Kanner moonwalked smoothly backward from his long litany of harsh comments. "We have in this country the National Association for Autistic Children," Kanner said, referring to Rimland's organization in a speech in St. Louis. "The parents are finally rebelling against this assumption of guilt and being made to feel the culprits, and they have encouraged further research and got together to help themselves, as well as those who were interested in the topic." And against whom were these parents rebelling? Why, certainly not Leo Kanner. He made it clear he was talking about Bruno Bettelheim. "In the first publication of the 11 children," Kanner said, "I said all the other things I reported were facts, and this was an opinion at that time that I felt very definitely that these children have some inherent, innate difficulty of relationship with people. But there were others who felt, even so, that this is caused entirely and exclusively by some emotional conflict of the parents, especially the mother. In fact, a book appeared, a bestseller by a well-known psychologist, describing the behavior of these children beautifully, but then decided that it's the parents' wish to see the child dead that causes the child to play possum more and more definitely. That book many of you know called The Empty Fortress. I found it an empty book." Kanner's turnabout reflects the revolution wrought by Rimland, creating a new disease model atop the ashes of the old Freudian theory. In its place is the alternative that Rimland pointed to as early as his 1959 letter to Kanner. "I have been mainly concerned with trying to find biological factors which might eventually help beat the problem." Autism in this model belongs to biology, not psychiatry. It is a specific disease entity, a complex response to genetic and/or biological events. Mothers have nothing to do with causing autism. Autism is a lifelong disorder. But it took time for this paradigm shift, launched by Rimland, to take hold. Bettelheim's The Empty Fortress actually came 3 years after Rimland's book, in 1967, and if there were any doubt who was the mainstream's approved autism specialist, one need look no further than the pages of the New York Times in 1967. In a lengthy, bylined piece in the Times magazine, Bettelheim was given ample room to elaborate his theories under the title Where Self Begins. The Times put its full editorial seal of approval behind Bettelheim 2 weeks later. Foremost among the handful of psychiatrists and psychologists who have dedicated themselves to unraveling the puzzle of autistic behavior is Bruno Bettelheim, wrote the paper on February 26. No brief review can do justice to his wisdom or his compassion. A full-scale review followed in March, and 2 months after that, the book was on the recommended summer reading list. The Times did run a brief letter from Rimland blasting Bettelheim to heap guilt based on disproven, circumstantial evidence on these parents is an act of irresponsible cruelty. But time and truth were on Rimland's side, and a moment of triumph came at the 1969 meeting of the National Society for Autistic Children, which he founded. According to a transcript of a tape recording, Kanner again blasted Bettelheim's empty book and said, "And herewith, I especially acquit you people as parents. I have been misquoted many times. From the very first publication until the last, I spoke of this condition in no uncertain terms as innate. But because I described some of the characteristics of some of the parents as persons, I was misquoted often as having said, it is all the parents' fault. Those of you parents who have come to see me with your children know that this isn't what I said. As a matter of fact, I have tried to relieve parental anxiety when they had been made anxious because of such speculation." So if autism was innate, and it wasn't the parents' fault, What caused it? Twin studies and genetics. One of the strongest lines of evidence against psychogenic etiology of autism has come to light only in recent years, Bernard Rimland wrote in Infantile Autism. He was referring to increasing reports in the 1950s of identical twins with autism. Compiling his own list of previous reports, in effect, the first survey of twins and autism, he found 11 cases in which both twins were autistic. All of them were monozygotic, or identical, twins, a remarkable finding given that only one birth in 285 is an identical twin. By then, Leo Kanner had reported a total of fewer than 150 cases of autism in total, with so few cases reported, to find that 11 were cases in which both identical twins were affected was highly unusual. Rimland concluded that this high rate of autism in twins seems highly significant in terms of the biological etiology of the disease. When he and Mary Coleman had studied autistic children at the Washington Gathering, one of their observations was that there seemed to be familial clustering. They noted the then-current estimate of between 3 and 4 autistic children per 10,000, meaning that one would expect to find family groupings only in extremely rare instances. Yet, in their study of 78 autistic children, they found 6 families in which there was more than one child afflicted, a total of more than 8% of the families in the sample. They also found a rather high incidence of twins, and suggested the reason might not have to be genetic. Of course, twins share the same intrauterine environment, so evidence from twin studies can apply to gestational insults as well as patterns of genetic inheritance. Twins provide a unique opportunity to compare the effects of genetics and environment. Identical twins have identical DNA, while fraternal twins have no more shared DNA makeup than regular siblings. As a result, numerous studies compare disease rates in identical and fraternal twins. 3 years later came the first formal autism twin study. It was authored by Susan Folstein and Michael Rutter, the man who developed the modern classification system for autism. The first post-Kanner update. They reported 21 twin pairs, 11 identical, and 10 fraternal, in which at least one of the twins was autistic. They found a relatively modest rate of both twins having autism, the concordance rate. 4 out of 11 identical twins, or 36%, were both autistic. They said the remaining twin in 5 more pairs had a cognitive disorder like language delay. Among fraternal twins, the concordance rate was 0. While the higher concordance rate among the identical twins pointed to a potential biological role, the fact that the majority were discordant is a point that quickly became lost. Subsequent investigators, bent on establishing the solely genetic basis of the disorder, blurred or glossed over the differences in the remaining cases. Take case 8, in which Folstein and Rutter described the identical twins, 10-year-old boys, as discordant for autism, concordant for cognitive and social-emotional disorder. The firstborn was classically autistic. His twin, by contrast, was described in detail in the study as a cuddly, responsive baby. Single words, 23 months. Phrases after 3 years. Vocabulary, adequate. But limited social speech. Normal relationship parents. Only recently started to play peers. Does not initiate interaction. Anxious. No resistance to change. Series of circumscribed solitary interests, currently marbles. Shy, but friendly boy. There is a world of difference between these two children, obviously. A shy but friendly boy with a normal relationship to his parents, going through a phase of fascination with marbles, does not belong in the same diagnostic category as a child with no functional language, who rocks and flaps and has repetitive behaviors and no affective contact. The hallmarks of autism. This suggests that concordance for cognitive, social, and emotional disorder vastly overstates the genetic case for autism. The contrast in other cases was even starker. In twin girls, age 5, one of whom was severely autistic, the other was diagnosed as concordant for cognitive disorder, but developed speech normally and had normal relationship with parents, but slightly less sympathetic and affectionate than siblings. Plays well with sibs, but less with peers at school. Drawing immature. At interview appears friendly, responsive, inquisitive girl. From this description, it is frankly difficult to see how the second twin can even be classified as having a cognitive disorder. In addition, being raised with a profoundly disabled twin might have had subtle adverse effects on the typical one. For almost a decade, there was nothing more published on autism and twins. Then, in 1985, Edward Ritvo and colleagues at the University of California, Los Angeles, came up with a strikingly different result. In a larger sample of 40 twin pairs, 23 identical and 17 fraternal, they found that 96% of the identical twins were concordant for autism, and 23.5% of the fraternal twins were concordant. Both numbers obviously were far higher than those in Folstein and Rutter's study. Ritvo made the suggestion that based on the arithmetic, nearly 100% concordance in identical twins, close to 25% in fraternal twins, autism could be the result of a simple recessive gene. While that theory was not borne out, the higher rate of fraternal concordance was striking. Researchers who expected to confirm a genetic basis for autism would anticipate low concordance for fraternal twin pairs because their genetic material is not identical. And while there is some suggestion of a high shared rate of autism among siblings, it is nothing close to 25%. Ritvo's findings, contrary to his own interpretation, suggested that fraternal twins shared some kind of environmental risk factor in the womb, a risk that might explain the higher rate in identical twins as well. In a sharp critique of the autism twin studies, Jay Joseph, a vocal critic of the way such studies are used to support genetic theories and diminish the role of the environment in disease, noted the incoherent interpretations of Ritvo's evidence, which clearly argued for environmental risks in the womb. Rather than explain how Ritvo's 23.5% concordance rate is explainable on genetic grounds, wrote Joseph, Folstein, Rutter, and the authors of the two subsequent twin studies attempted to discredit, dismiss, or ignore this finding. He notes that a 1991 review by Folstein criticized a number of methodological problems in the Ritvo study. A Scandinavian group demeaned the Ritvo investigation as unacceptable because cases were recruited largely from a pool of replies to a newsletter announcement of the National Society for Autistic Children, which could lead to an over-inclusion of concordant and monozygotic cases. Finally, in a 1995 twin study, the authors wrote Ritvo et al. Out of the history of autism research, citing only the Folstein and Rutter and Swedish studies as the two previous epidemiological studies of autistic twins. Indeed, Ritvo's study was not mentioned or cited at all by the 1995 authors. After Folstein and Rutter and Ritvo came up with two wildly different findings, two subsequent studies followed that would soon come to dominate the discussion. The small Scandinavian study mentioned previously found that 10 out of 11 identical twin pairs were concordant for autism, and 0 out of 10 fraternal twin pairs. Joseph is highly critical of their methods as well, and points to their self-serving analysis of the Ritvo study. Given the methodological problems, biases, and dubious assumptions in twin research in general, however, this study does not stand out as a noteworthy example of biased research. I mention these issues only to point out that the Scandinavian study, like Ritvo and colleagues, and most other twin studies, is subject to several potentially invalidating methodological problems and biases. Thus, it was improper for the Scandinavians and others to single out Ridbo's studies as being qualitatively more biased than other twin studies of autism. In 1995, nearly 20 years after Folstein and Rutter's first study, a fourth study by British researchers, including Rutter, added a new group of 17 identical and 11 fraternal twins. Their desire to settle on a conclusion seemed evident in their title: Autism as a Strongly Genetic Disorder, Evidence from a British Twin Study. These British researchers pooled their new twin sample with the 20-year-old sample from Folstein and Rutter's original study, and argued that they had found a 69% concordance rate in identicals and zero concordance in fraternals. This had the effect of diminishing the findings of the older identical twin set in Folstein and Rutter, which was discordant in 64% of cases. In the British study, like the previous Scandinavian study, none of the 11 fraternal twin pairs included in the sample were concordant for autism. In our view, this finding supported the bias of the investigators, which was to create the widest possible gap between the genetically identical group and the fraternal twins. The British group went on to perform a calculation of heritability, the percentage of autism's causality that could be assigned to purely genetic factors. They estimated the heritability of autism at 92%. J. Joseph points out an important inconsistency in their methods. The heritability calculations would have been thrown off by the zero rate of concordance in fraternal twins, a rate that was too low for the formula they were using. The investigators came up with a solution to this. As they continued to collect cases after the study period was closed, they reported that the next DZ pair seem, emphasis added, was concordant for autism. Joseph noted that although the British researchers used this concordant set of fraternal twins in their calculation for heritability, they did not include it in their published results, which listed a 0% rate. In reality, the British concordance rate for fraternal twins was 9%, a result that fell awkwardly between Folstein and Rutter's 0% and Ritvo's 23.5% in fraternal twins. Most important, the rate of fraternal concordance they used for their heritability calculation was only 3%. The pooled concordance rates for all four studies were 77% for identical twins and 10% for fraternal twins, if Ritvo and the late addition to the British study are included. This is still a big difference, but the British study and the 92% heritability rate have become articles of faith rather than analysis, and are frequently repeated in more than a decade's worth of autism and genetics papers. Subsequent twin studies would suggest that the gap between identical and fraternal concordance rates has grown even narrower in recent years, arguing that environmental factors in the womb have more to do with the finding than the genetic profile of the twins themselves. A recently published concordance study from Japan is closer to Ritvo's results than anything else. In the meantime, a host of other technical arguments, such as that identical twins are more likely to share an intrauterine environment, specifically a single chorion, the same fetal membrane, and placenta, point out that dangers of overinterpreting these and other concordance findings. But none of that has mattered, as the rush to genetics has taken autism research by storm. The path not taken. Autism is remarkable for having been the subject of two fully developed, but fundamentally faulty, theories of causation within the first few decades of its discovery. In retrospect, the parental behavior model was just waiting to be demolished. It could not withstand the rigors of Bernie Rimland's penetrating critique, nor the rising observations of genetic susceptibility contained in the twin observations. Its roots in Leo Kanner's misunderstandings of the parents' backgrounds and behavior were taken to such a bizarre extreme by Bruno Bettelheim that even Kanner distanced himself from the implications. The genetic model that rose in its place seemed better grounded in science and, at the same time, more humane. The parents had done nothing wrong, and there was no disputing some biological factor was at work based on the twin concordance data. But once again, the possibility that this factor reflected a shared environmental risk in children with genetic vulnerabilities, rather than simple heritability, was overlooked. Rutter himself, in 2008, acknowledged that the truth may be that there is much more gene-environment interdependence than has been appreciated until now. Effectively returning the argument to the same point Rimland and Coleman made in 1974. The likelihood that evidence from twin studies could just as easily apply to gestational insults as patterns of genetic inheritance. With Freud's influence on the wane and funding for biological and genetic research on the rise, genes became the new target of opportunity. Refrigerator mothers were exorcised, but chemical exposures were ignored. The triumph of Bernard Rimland and Mary Coleman was to turn autism into a biological disorder. But science promptly forgot environmental biology as it veered single-mindedly to genetics. In the meantime, the diagnostic tools for autism were being honed. Rutter himself systematized Kanner's diagnostic markers in 1978. After two subsequent updates, the 1994 edition of The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders included Asperger's syndrome. The medicalization of autism had begun. In reading the different generations of diagnostic criteria from Rutter to the 1994 update, it's clear that none of the revisions marked a point of departure from Kanner's original vision. Each revision was simply an attempt to make diagnosis easier for the practicing clinician. Indeed, the latest update in 1994 was defined as a corrective narrowing. It's impossible to read the post-Kanner discussions of autism without coming across complaints that autism was overdiagnosed. And nowhere is it suggested that vast hordes of autistic cases were going overlooked. Despite all this new interest in biological issues, not much progress was made in finding causes. Genes, in particular, stubbornly refused to submit to discovery. And then, something important happened. The early autism prevalence estimates of 1 in 2,400 to 1 in 10,000, which had held constant for three decades, suddenly began to look obsolete. Autism rates started to rise.